Well, good morning, Redemption Church. How are you guys doing today? I didn't see that coming, really. I thought that was just, you know, like a gimme, and they'd be like, I'm good, we're here, yeah, whatever else. But I'm glad to hear that this morning. Also to everybody online, good morning to you. Good to see you guys. A couple of things really quick. First of all, the Boswells slash the Pratts have a new baby granddaughter slash daughter. That's a happy new one for us. And so our sweet daughter, she went into labor on Sunday but didn't give birth till late Tuesday night. Yeah, that was a bummer for her. But hey, a little girl is great, awesome, everything else. Everybody's doing wonderful all the way around. What did I say? That was the most chauvinistic thing I could say all morning, isn't it? Says another woman getting ready to have a child, like, oh yeah, bummer for her, because you'll never push a child out of your body, so. Fair enough, my friend, fair enough. Bad me, all right? So, I own that one. That was bad. All right, so, honor if you're watching. Your dad's got issues, all right? So you know how to pray for me now. So that's the first new thing. Let's move on from that new thing. The second new thing is next week we're going to have a brand new series. We're going to be kicking off. It is called, let's see the slide, and or looking at all kinds of things, like just the hot topics of the day. It's like hot potato, but for church. Should be a good time. Also, that's a series that you might want to really consider bringing a friend to. Because we're going to try to get into the weeds on things, and especially things that are divided and everything else, and then maybe how we reason through that. And for us as followers of Jesus, how we really bring Jesus in that kind of conversation, in those topics, and we try to be the peacemakers in our world. So that's next week. As for today, we're finally wrapping up our series, What Did You Say? And we have navigated a lot of terrain in this, right? We've looked at speaking words to truth or air. That was week one, where it's just, man, we realize words have power. With that, we looked at how we use words about others. We looked at how we use words toward others. We then noted how we need to have words that heal. And so today is really kind of like this weird recap, rehash, revisit, not of everything in the exact same way, but I wanted to just have a day where it was like, what are some hacks, some tricks, some tips that we can all kind of remember, or at least if you have our app, you can take the notes, fill in these notes, and hold on to this, because there's going to come a time where you're like, oh, I have to have this kind of conversation, or oh, this thing came up, and maybe these little tools that we're going to hit today will be a good resource for you, so you can kind of keep that in mind. So we're going to be covering a lot of ground today. We're going to move really fast, so I'm going to go ahead and just open us up with a word of prayer and then get right to business. Jesus, I thank you for, again, your scriptures that give wisdom for life. It gives wisdom both in things not to do as well as things to do. And I pray all the more that we will lean into the to-dos, we will stay away from the not-to-dos as they kind of become apparent to us. And so I ask for guidance today. I ask for your insight and care toward us. I ask that you will just really help us to be strong and wise in all that we do. And so Jesus, we love you, we thank you, and we praise you in your good and perfect name. Amen. So I'm still thinking about that. I'm sitting there praying, but I'm still thinking about it. And I'm thinking about today's about words and how my words were stupid already. And so I'm going to doubly pay attention to what I'm talking about today, all right? And so I want to turn our attention right off the bat to the final time that we're going to look at Jesus' words on provocative and probing words. When he talks about words, he has these words about words, and I want to revisit it for our last time. He says it in Matthew chapter 12. He says, a tree is identified by its fruit. And if a tree is good, its fruit will be good. But if a tree is bad, its fruit will be bad. Thus, whatever is in your heart determines what you say. That's why we've made a big deal about, hey, we need to reform the heart. We need to refab the heart. We need to educate the heart if we're going to educate how we use our words. Thus, he says in verse 35, a good person produces good words, because that's really the conversation here. He produces good words from the treasury of a good heart, and an evil person produces evil words from the treasury of an evil heart. And I tell you this, you must give an account on Judgment Day, even for every idle word you speak. Now, I bring that up because I've read it almost every one of the Sundays in the series. But I was thinking about this really practically, right? Like, I started to back up on this and not just be like, oh, there's a Jesusism and it's in red letters. That's really important. But I started thinking about, like, okay, he has some words on words, and I want to think really concretely about my words. And so with that, I started putting together like a thing. I sketch a lot of pictures in my study notes because I'm a visual person. And so I did a little bit of research and found that the average American uses between 7,000 and 20,000 words a day. That's a gulf, I know, but some of us are people of few words and others are just, I love to talk, right? So there's all of that range in there, right? And it kind of falls on a spectrum. And according to Jesus, there's three elements of the spectrum. There is kind of good words, there's idle words, and then there's evil words. And I think even that throws us off a little bit because we might think to ourselves like, you know what, I probably could have more good words in my life, probably have a lot of idle words in my life, but I don't have that many evil words in my life necessarily. But part of the problem is those are kind of religious sounding words. And if you really kind of look at the Greek, which is the language that it was written in, Jesus spoke probably Aramaic, but they recorded his words in Greek. Those words don't have quite the same kind of edge to them. In part because this is an agricultural example that he's using. So the idea of good words are fruitful words. And the idea of idle words are just fruitless words, trees with no fruit. And then the idea of evil is really like rotten fruit. And so even when you look at it that way, it's kind of like, what are the words that bring flourishing? What are the words that bring burden? What are the words that are just blather, you know what I mean, out there in the kind of the netherworld or whatever else? And so I started thinking about that so I can understand, while it's very easy for me to say, I don't have a lot of evil words, once I realize that evil just means not the most helpful, not the most fruitful, a little bit rotten at times, maybe don't produce flourishing, create burden in a person's life, hurt or hardship in a person's life, then I realize, like, man, I might have some words that are, they're more on that end of the spectrum. And then certainly the idle words, like all the joking and silliness and ridiculous stories and all the things we do, all the more kind of highlights the risk of this. So then I took all of that, and I concluded from my life, basically, that the minority stake is going to be on good words and evil words, and the majority is probably going to be on those idle words, right? That's going to be the stakeholder for sure, because every single day there are thousands of words that are going to come out of my mouth that are just kind of in that category, right? But then I started to kind of drill down a little deeper, and I started to think about it in terms of if I was really conservative, and I said on any given day, I have 7,000 words, that's it. I go for the low end on this one. And then I go, of the idle words, let's say I just speak 70 idle words. And when it comes to the evil words, I only speak 7 per day. On that ratio, it's like, hey man, my idle words would only be 1%, and my evil words would only be 0.1%, 0.1%. That would be great. But then I looked at another number, and that number is 28,854. Does anybody know that number? That is the average amount of days we will all live as human beings. So then I did my math again. If I just had 70 idle words a day, I have over 2 million words to account for one day. If I only have 7 like evil, rotten, unhelpful words per day, I've got over 200,000 words to account for. And guess what, kids? I use a lot more of all of those words, right? A lot more. I was laughing, man. Like, and it was funny because people do this with me too, but I would do the same thing. In this whole series, I'll be out in the foyer after a talk, right, talking to somebody, and literally I will violate the very thing I was talking about like 5 minutes earlier. And I'm suddenly like talking about somebody that this person does not need to know that I know. You know, I was like, what am I doing? And I had people even say stuff to me, and then they go, oh yeah, but that was gossiping, wasn't it? I'm like, well, you called it, not me, but whatever. So we all kind of fall into this. And so I bring this up to say, you know what, I think there is a real reason for all of us to kind of sit up, pay attention, and try to gather as many tools as we can. And so today is all about speaking for dummies. Not speaking on behalf of dummies, but rather learning to speak because we all are dummies when it comes to the words that we use. Now, we're going to go kind of two routes on this. I'm hitting two angles. I'm going to hit like some general principles that probably if you just kind of operate by these principles, no matter what comes your way, you're going to do well. But then also we're going to get into the weeds on some specific things. It's like boots on the ground versus kind of an air war attack and say, man, from both ends, I want to know how to be specific and how I want to be detailed and how I want to be general and how I want to be over the top of everything on a way to really have some tools to use words in a consistent fashion. And so I'm going to look at, first of all, like that big picture. That's going to be the first angle. And we're going to call that the strategic point of view. And when it comes to being strategic, I want to talk about living a zone coverage when it comes to our words. Now, I know many of you, men and women alike, are very sports-minded. Like, I remember a few decades ago, it was like, men watch sports and women do other things. No, man, women are some of the biggest sports fans in my life. And so I love the fact that there is a high sports IQ in general around our church with this. But if you're unfamiliar with sport, we'll say it that way, there are two ways you can handle defense. One way is man-to-man. I think we have a picture of it. We're going to use basketball because it's the easiest way to describe it, right? But man-to-man is where it's like, I'm number 7 and you're number 5, and wherever number 5 goes, number 7 follows, right? So you're just going to follow the same, that's man-to-man, right? Zone is where it's like, man, I'm not chasing 5-7, 7-5. I'm staying in a certain area, and I just kind of guard that area. So when we're talking about zone, these are these ideas that are general. They can work in all environments, and you're just kind of using them in anything that comes your way. So it's one of those kind of hat tricks that kind of fits all the categories simultaneously. And so with that, here's some things maybe to think about the big picture, things to default to as I'm dealing with conversations in life. The first is make the golden rule your default. Right? In life, just think about the golden rule. Jesus said it in Matthew 7. He says, in everything, which by the way, in Greek, everything literally means everything, go figure. In everything, therefore, treat people the same as you would want them to treat you. This is the essence of all that is taught in the law and the prophets. So 613 laws, all that front end big Bible. He's like, that's the essence of what's there, right? And it makes sense because here's the thing. I want to take this and go, all right, what tone, what talk, what temperament causes me to lean in and listen? And then what tone, talk, and temperament causes me to kind of pull back when somebody's doing it to me? And whatever causes me to lean in, then I want to duplicate that kind of methodology for communication. And whatever causes me to back off and think you're a risk, I don't want to do that same thing to another person. So what I love about Jesus' instruction here is it puts it back into my own skin for a minute, and I just can use myself as the assessment. Would I bristle under that? Would I be offended by that? Would I want to reject that? Well, then I don't want to bring that to another person. I want to bring the things that bring health and flourishing and encouragement and everything else, right? That's what we should do. So it's less about what should I say and more about how should I say it in a way that they can receive it. Because at the end of the day, I don't want to get at a person. I want the person to get the thing I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to beat or win or be smarter. I'm trying to have connectivity and transparency and unity in the things that I'm saying and doing, right? And so that should be kind of that natural default. I think from there, these other things flow pretty quickly. It should be that I am caring over judging, right? That, like, because judgment, I'll just be honest with you. I'm always preaching against judgment. You know why? Because I'm so good at it. Like, honestly, like, I love to think that I'm just so anti-judging and judgmental, but deep down inside, I'm judgy and judgmental, and we all are. But we'll do better to be caring than judging. Judging's easy. Caring, we think it's easy. Sometimes it's hard, especially with people that you find a little difficult, but that's a good place to default to. Probably closely aligned with this is curiosity over know-it-allism. Like, I may think I know everything about this person, this problem, this situation, this occurrence, but I really don't. I don't know what's going on in them, what's going on in their lives. There's a lot of things I don't know. So I should enter in more curious with questions than just conclusions that I know everything with. Probably closely aligned with this is confirmation over speculation, right? Make sure I got the facts right. We learned a verse from that last week. We just look dumb when we don't gather all the information before spouting off. Here I want to make sure that I get it before I fully render a conclusion. And then all of this is predicated on what Jesus said in Matthew 12, knowing that all plays will be reviewed by Jesus. Good sports metaphor, right? One day, I'm going to be with Jesus. He's like, really? You thought it was just going to be 2 million idle words, bro? Come on. You're in the billions, man. You lived a long time. You said a lot of stuff. You were dumb. You were a preacher. You even had more words, you fool. You know, like that's going to be the reality. And so I go, man, this is great just to think in these terms because it sets a posture. And I think the posture that it sets is that we're looking at everybody in our lives, no matter who they are. We like them, don't like them, they don't like us, they love us, whatever it is. We're always kind of in this posture that says, I'm not above you, I'm not better than you, I'm not smarter than you. Rather, I'm coming alongside you, I care about you, I'm an equal to you. even if you're a boss or a leader or a coach and you actually have the responsibility to be, quote, over people, you can do that, and I think most effectively, when it feels like and sounds like you are coming alongside with them, right? That's the best leadership, right? Even if you have to say a hard thing, they know you're in it with them and you care about them and you're saying it for their good, not simply because you're just trying to be right or whatever else. And so all of this is really helpful, right? It gives us, again, a little bit of this idea of tone when it comes to our talk so that our talk has the healthiest tone. Now, with all of that, you may say, Matt, that's great. I love it. I want to try to do those things. But, bro, there's specific things in life that are issues, right? There are going to be different topics or events or things that are sticky. So what do I do with all of those types of things? Well, that gets into the tactical side then, right? Boots on the ground, what it means to live wisely in that man-to-man coverage. In other words, what do I do in a given instance with a given person or group of people and all the different ways that talk gets leveraged and used? That's the heart behind this particular point, because here's the deal. We all know we're going to misspeak. We're going to have miscues, misunderstandings, misinformation. It's all going to be there. We're going to make mistakes in the way we handle other people. We're going to make statements that are just mad at times, even at the people we love. So over the course of those 28,854 days, how do we try to do this better? How do we get better, so to speak, at our banter? Well, the first way we can be wise is regarding the sharing of unflattering facts. The sharing of unflattering facts. Now, the Bible calls it gossip, and we learn that there's a difference between like gossip and slander. Slander is a little bit more like deception every time. Gossip is weird because sometimes gossip is a lie, but oftentimes gossip might be the truth about a person or a circumstance, right? But it's an unflattering truth about that person or circumstance. So kind of in that space, like what do we do, right? What do we do with that? See, this is important because this is where it does come up. I mean, there are things where it's a fact, it's unflattering, and then we share those facts with family members or with friends, or certain neighborhoods are awesome at this, especially in Duval. Some neighborhoods really do get good at this. And certainly in culture we see it, right? We see it with the press and with pundits and politicians. I mean, paparazzi, you name it, all the P's are covered there, right? Like they all kind of engage in this thing of, hey, if it's true, you say it no matter what, no matter how it hurts, what it does, you know, what it blows up, it's just permissible to say. And the question is it always permissible? Because I think oftentimes gossip ends up just being malicious. Like, I don't need to say this, you don't need to know about it, you're not a part of the problem, nor are you part of the solution, but I got nothing better to do but to tell you about this thing about this other person because it's kind of fun. Right? That's a way that it can happen. And I go, for that part of it, that's a problem. But I do think, and I was having a conversation with my friend Joe Mazzacini about this a few weeks ago, there is, I'm not going to say there may be, there is times and places where there is a necessity to share an unflattering fact about a person with another person or another group. There are occasions or occurrences where that's needed. Now, to make sure we keep some clarity on this, I think when it's just telling people stuff that they don't need to know, that should just be like a non-starter. That's a bad idea. That's not a healthy thing. Proverbs 11:13. A gossip goes around telling secrets, but those who are trustworthy can keep a confidence. So that's even a tool. Like, if I'm going to share this with this other person, is this a trustworthy act, or is this more of a gossipy act? Like, am I just doing it to do it, or is there a real intention behind it? You might run that little thought experiment, though, and say, you know what? There is a reason. This is an occurrence where it'd be a trustworthy thing for me to do this. If you find that you're in that space, I'm going to give you three things that you want to consider if you're going to share that information. First of all, be discreet. Be discreet. What I mean by that is only share that information with people that actually need to know. And I go back to that Rick Warren definition. If they're a part of the problem or a part of the solution, you share that with them. Or maybe even if it's, hey, there's a circumstance where this person, this family needs to know this thing. I'm not trying to throw this other person under the bus, but they need to know. They're going to do a business dealing with them, and here's the problem. They're going to let that person watch their kids, and here's the situation. Like, there may be a time and place for that, and therefore, be discreet. The second thing, be precise, right? Just the facts that are pertinent. Don't throw in your commentary, your assumption, your added speculation, or whatever else. Just be precise. Here's the thing I need to let you know about. Here's the situation. And I think, in that, the third thing is be fair. be fair, right? You may not like the person, and it's easy when we don't like somebody and we're having to share information about a person we don't like to just not be as fair. Like if it was somebody we really loved, we would say it differently than somebody we don't like. But this is where we want to go. No, I don't want to do that. I'm not trying to make a bad thing worse or a painful thing even more painful. If I'm unsure of certain facts, I want to say, I don't know about that. I'm not certain. I don't want to speculate on those things, right? But that's the way I think it needs to happen. In fact, I would liken it to Lady Justice. You know how she's blind and has the scale, and it's this dispassionate decision-making of facts? In some ways, if we're sharing information about another person with some other person, as much as we can, we want to kind of approach it like that blind justice perspective, right? I'm not trying to get you fired up. I'm just trying to bring you in on something so hopefully it's more helpful than hurtful in the end. Now, on the other end of this, idea of kind of gossip that's a fact, is this idea of like hearsay, right? Rumor. And when it comes to rumors and unverified information, here's my advice. Don't. Just don't do it. Don't get involved, right? Real quick. Don't seek out rumors, right? Just don't seek them out. Like if somebody's saying something, you're like, ooh, what's that about? Don't seek it out. You're looking for trouble if you do, because now you're kind of an accomplice in the whole thing. The Bible talks about that. Like if you're like making yourself a person that's like interested in getting it, that's like now you're in it, and just do yourself a favor and don't seek rumors out. Next, don't let them in. Bible warns about that too, right? Because as soon as they're in, now you're left to speculate. You're left to wonder. You're making decisions and assessments and judgment. And then finally, don't spread them around. If you have heard and you're like, maybe, do yourself a favor. Do the people around you a favor and don't spread them around. And this goes at multiple levels. It could be as clear as just person to person relationally. But I also say we live in a time, we live in a culture with this thing called the internet, a blessing and a curse all at once. That offers a lot of conspiracy, a lot of false information. There's this whole thing. And we as Christians should be discerning, right? Like that's part of what the scriptures call us to, is a sense of discerning. So if you come across a rumor and it verifies your worldview, don't just believe it because it verifies your worldview. Verify this thing before you spread it about. Or if it's something that is contrary to your worldview, verify it before you spread it around, right? Like that's just the thing. And it's hard to do. I know we get so many things thrown at us every single day, but the more we're trying to be that discerning, verifying, calm presence, the better off it's going to be. Exodus 23 says, "You must not pass along false rumors. Be sure to never charge anyone falsely with evil." See, I really do think this is really good, especially in our current climate where the political parties that be and the social divides that there are just vilifying each other again. To like slow the roll and be like, man, you know what? I don't know if half of this is really true, or maybe it's such an over-exaggeration. The truth is more in the middle. Whatever it is, it's trying to make sure that we're not a part of the problem, but we're a part of the solution. In fact, there was a great passage I came across this week. It's weird because it's not in the Protestant Bible. It's in the book of Sirach, which is just here, like you're in seminary for a second. So there's the Old Testament, and then there's something called the Deuterocanonical Testament, which was kind of the tail end of the Old Testament period. There's a number of writings, and for a long time, these were kind of considered a part of the Bible. We got to the Protestant Reformation. Some parts came out, some parts stayed. This was one of those. Some people call it the Apocrypha, right? There's cool stuff in it, no matter how you want to land on that or whatever else. And I read it this week, and I thought, this is so fitting for this, right? So it says in Sirach 19:11, "Have you heard a rumor? Let it die with you. Be brave," it says. It will not make you explode. And I think that's so good, right? It's like you heard something, I gotta share it, but it may be false. I don't care. I gotta let people know. I gotta let it out. I'm gonna blow up if I don't. Shut up. You won't blow up. That's what he's saying. You're not gonna explode. Don't share it, right? How about this one? What about things regarding arguments and fights? Not rumors, not gossip, but arguments and fights. Here's the thing. Fights will come. Death, taxes, fights. They're all guaranteed in life. And for some of you, you're like, yeah, I know. We had one this morning before we got to church, right? Like, or the kids were in the back seat and they were, whatever it is, like it was there, right? So they're gonna happen. What do we do when they're coming up? What do we do when you could feel it stirring in the environment, all right? Here's some quick little nuggets to aspire to. First, if there's something going on and there's a time delay between your interaction, don't come to pick a fight, but to raise an issue. This is just a mindset, right? That says, you know what, I'm not going to this like, oh man, I'm gonna let them, I'm gonna tear off their head. I'm gonna, whatever the thing is, like you can come in with this energy. We're like, no, I want to fight. Don't go in to pick a fight. Go in to really like raise a problem, raise an issue. Proverbs 17, 14, starting a quarrel is like opening a floodgate, so stop before the dispute breaks out. I get it, in real time, in the moment, it's really easy to just go from like I don't know, like mild to extra spicy, like I get that. It just is happening and you're just out of control a little bit. But for those times where it's like, we need to talk when you get home or what, like be working through, like I wanna really raise an issue, I don't wanna pick a fight. Next, my wife and I talk about this all the time. Make the problem, not the person. Now you may say, but Matt, the person's the problem. No, usually the person has done something that's created a problem. The person has introduced a problem, but it's not always the person. Sometimes the problem's just the problem. And Ellen and I will do that. We'll just actually sometimes consciously stop and like, we need to make the problem, because we're coming at each other when we really need to solve this thing. Maybe I instigated it, maybe she instigated it, maybe life instigated it, whatever it is. But we're conflicting, and we're like, wait, we're not solving, we're just fighting. We need to slow down and begin to actually solve. Maybe in this, and this is tough again in the moment, but I think it's good to say, fight fair. Just fight fair. Sometimes in arguments, when you feel like you're losing a little bit, you'll drag something in from the past, whoop, boom, and throw it on the table. Remember when you did this? And you're like, but I asked for forgiveness, but it's back, baby, because I'm losing, right? That's not fighting fair. I love what Joseph Taliskin said. He says, the time to avoid making ugly comments is before they leave your mouth, right? And it's really good, man. It's really good. And I've tried to embrace that more and more and more, and I'm not perfect at it, but I'm trying to get better where it's like, sit on that, Matt. Is that really going to fix this, or is it going to break this? That leads to the last part in this one. Fight to fix, not to win. Fight to fix, not to win. I know sometimes in a really broken marriage or really taxing parenting issues or a really tough boss or whatever it is, it's really tough to be thinking about doing that. And I know not all things are fixable. I understand that too. But it reminds me of Paul in Romans 12, and he says, as much as it depends on you, live at peace with all people. Like you're doing your best to try to do this thing. I think about Ephesians 4. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor. He says, let no corrupt talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as is fitting for the occasion, that may give grace to the hearers. I think this is good because, again, it just reminds me of, like, if I'm saying things that are not building, but are belittling or trying to best the other person, I probably should change my tactic and try to get to something that's more constructive than destructive. Now, probably aligned with this is the next thing in our notes. It's regarding starting observation conversations or criticisms, right? Or kind of stating, sharing these things. And I use both words, criticism and observation, for a reason. I use criticism because that's kind of technically what it is. I use observation because I want that to be the tone that we consider in these kinds of things, right? Because here's the thing. If you've ever had somebody sit you down and constructively criticize you, which already sounds worse as it is when you say it that way, right? If you've ever had that and it was done poorly, you know how that goes, right? You're defensive really quickly. It's tough to absorb all of that. And also, I've had times in my life, I can think of one really particular one, where I had to do this with a person, and I did it so poorly. And I went in with so much of that know-it-all mentality as opposed to curious and kind of careful or whatever. I did it in such an abrasive way, and I thought I was so smart and so right at the time. I almost made it impossible for the person to absorb what I'm saying, right? Like, they were just on the defensive. They were ready to kind of fight. They were not going to receive a single word because they felt attacked. And so based on this, I just try to think of my own life. Like, what's the best route? When I observe a problem where I have to have a conversation, and we could call it constructive criticism, but I want it to be better than just criticism, something more valuable, how should I do this? How should we do this? Real quick, four things. First of all, be private when you go to the person, right? Don't do it in a group, right? I've seen that happen, right? Especially like at a family gathering, like Thanksgiving, suddenly it's like Uncle Rico's problem is on the table for all to see. Like, don't do that. Right? That's not a healthy thing. You go to the person in private. Maybe the anomaly is like an intervention, like a family intervention. But I've done that before, and even that's a little tricky, right? Like, you want to be really sensitive about, you don't want to put extra eyes on the thing. Don't be telling a bunch of people, I'm going to go confront this person later today. Like, don't do that. Puts an added pressure that doesn't need to be there. Next, be peaceable as you share with that person. Don't feel it's your job to play the Holy Spirit or to scold them in some overbearing way. Just be peaceable. Like, you want them to absorb this as much as possible. In line with that, be pure in what you say about that person. Pure means you're picking the actual topics that matter, and that's what you're talking about, and you're not pulling in other things that are less the topic. Keep kind of the purity of the conversation of what the topic really is, and then in this, be precise with options for the person. In other words, if you say, hey, here's some things to work on in your life, you want to bring with that, and maybe here's some solutions, and I'm happy to help you with those solutions. Like, all of that needs to be in there. If it's just like, here's your problem, what should I do? I don't know, I'm just sick of your problem. And you walk, that didn't help, right? It's like, we want to come with something helpful and truly constructive to construct, to build a thing, when we have those kinds of conversations. Now, as an interesting little sidebar here for a minute, because I was thinking about this passage this week, and I thought, I think sometimes some Christians feel like, no, you need to come in like hot and hostile a little bit to make the point. And there may be a time and a place for that, you know, I don't know fully. But I think our justification for this comes out of something Jesus says in Luke 17. He starts off by saying, pay attention to yourselves, which is funny because that doesn't come up as much, and I think that's really valuable. Like, pay attention to yourselves. If another believer sins, rebuke that person. If there's repentance, forgive. If that person wrongs you 7 times in a day, each time turn again and they ask for forgiveness, you must forgive them. The forgiveness part is really great there, and even the whole pay attention to yourself is really critical there, but I want to look at the word rebuke. Because I think in our Christianese, we see that as like a fiery word, right? Like Pentecostal preachers use it. Like, I rebuke you, Satan, in the name of the Lord, you know? Like that kind of thing. Or you got to rebuke that person. I rebuke you, devil, whatever it is. And it's unfortunate because, again, the Greek word that is used here does not warrant that kind of magnitude. Epitimao, that's the word. And you know what it really means? To give honor in a weighted way. Like, how we get to this idea of, like, scold you out of this word is super weird. Part of it is because we dragged it in from an old French word, and the French like to scold. That's their game, right? But here, it has a lot more that idea of, I'm going to warn you, but instructionally. I'm going to coach you properly. So rebuke isn't like, I'm throttling you. Rebuke is like, man, I care about you. There's this thing I see with you or in you or around you, and I want to come in and wisely and carefully and thoughtfully instruct you. It's leveraging Proverbs chapter 12, verse 18. Some people make cutting remarks, but the words of the wise, they bring healing. Right? I'm not here to make cutting remarks. I want to bring healing. That's the desired outcome. I don't need to be right, but I want to help you get right. I want to be a healer. I don't want to simply be a critic. How about words that harm or humiliate? That's super easy. Don't do it. Words that harm or humiliate, don't do it. Don't defend those who do it. And don't kind of get on the case of people that are out there trying to tell other people, hey, don't do this. Right? Like, it's weird. I remember when there was a lot of these bullying campaigns that were rolling out. Like, hey, don't bully, don't bully. And there was actually people going, this is stupid. This is dumb. Oh, stop it. I'm like, listen, I train kids at the gym, and some of the kids that come to the gym are coming because they're bullied and they're tired of being bullied and they're trying to get strong or lose weight or whatever it is. And it's just like, I'm telling you, it hurts. It hurts. And I see adults that get bullied, but it hurts, right? I mean, we live in a culture that increasingly, it's just, that's the game. I mean, I remember in my lifetime, some of you are going to remember this, there used to be a time when politicians, we would actually sort of look at them and say, you exercise decorum. And now, man, sometimes it's politicians that use the bitiest, the meanest, the cruelest, the most bullyish words. And then people got to love it. Like, yeah, get them, red meat. And I'm like, no, man, as Christians, we shouldn't be that way. The world, let it be that way. We follow a Jesus who calls us to love our friends, love our loved ones, love our enemies, love our neighbors, which means there's no place for this kind of speak. In fact, it's interesting. I was thinking about a lament in Psalm 44. So the sons of Korah are the writers of this psalm, and they're sort of upset at God, and they're upset at their enemies, and it's all in there. And so they're saying to God through song, you let our neighbors mock us.
We're an object of scorn and derision to all those around us. You've made us the butt of their jokes, and they shake their heads in scorn. We can't escape the constant humiliation and shame. It's written across our face. We hear all their taunts. They are our mockers. I look at that and I go, man, I don't know if they're accurate to be mad at God about this, but I understand the feelings they have about their enemies. And that whole list I look at and I go, that's the kind of list we want to avoid. We don't want to be making people the butt of our jokes. We don't want to be mocking or bringing derision or scorn or taunts or shame. None of that. We want to be different, right? We want to be different. We don't want to do it. We don't want to condone it. Proverbs 13:5 reminds us the godly, they hate lies. The wicked, on the other hand, they cause shame and disgrace. If our words cause shame and disgrace in the lives of other people, then we're not doing our job as followers of Jesus. We should bring honor and favor in many of our words. But then there's this thing about lies. So let's get into lies for a minute. This will be fun. How much time do I have left? Good, I'm good. All right. This is going to be interesting, right? Because again, in the realm of lies, this is going to be a little nuanced. So I'm going to let you know. So there's like the Bible and Matt. We're kind of dancing between both a little bit right now because it's going to be, again, like I said, a nuanced kind of thing. Here's what I'm going to say. In the majority of cases, majority of the time, for the majority of circumstances, in general, truth is the default. Psalm 34:12, does anyone want to live a life that is long and prosperous? I do. Great. How do you do that? Verse 13. Then keep your tongue from speaking evil and your lips from telling lies. Like, there's your memory verse for the day right there. Solid, it's clear, it's concise, it's unambiguous. But then you get these weird anomalies in the scripture. For example, there's this one time in 1 Samuel 16 where God tells the prophet Samuel to lie to Saul about what he's up to. You're like, what? Say what? That's why I give you the verse reference. You can find it. It's in there. Read the chapter. Here's a crazier one. It's in 1 Kings chapter 22 and 2 Chronicles 18. It actually shows the scene. Go read it. It's weird. God is in heaven with this angelic council, and they're talking about what to do with King Ahab. So, like, God is conferring in heaven with this council, and one of the angels comes forward and says, how about we just put a lying spirit in the mouth of all the prophets? And God's like, great idea. You get a promotion. Go do that, right? And you're like, so God authorizes a lying spirit in the mouths of all the prophets. That's in 1 Kings 22, 2 Chronicles 18. We also see in Exodus 1 where the Hebrew midwives lie about all of the Hebrew women having the male Israelite children. They lie about that, and God gives them favor for that because they're lying to the Egyptians so that they're not throwing the children into the river. And then last, we see in the scriptures that Rahab is this woman of faith, but her faith is demonstrated by her deception in hiding the spies of Israel as they're coming into the land. And so while you have this general moral constant, you come across these things where you're like, oh, what do I do with all of that? And then because my master's is in philosophy, let's go down that road for a minute, right? This is the area that people have loved to debate forever, right? You have people like Augustine or Immanuel Kant who say a lie in any circumstance, any condition, is absolutely wrong every single time. Every time. Doesn't matter what it is. To save the life of your child, if it's a lie, it's wrong. It's sinful. You're evil. Like, they would go down to that space. But then you have, like, Plato or, you know, like, Mill or something. And they'll kind of go down the road of saying lies are mostly wrong, but sometimes for certain conditions, under certain humanitarian reasons, it may be, necessary. It may even be more moral. In Jesus' own world, there was two rabbinical schools, Shammai and Hillel. And Shammai taught that a lie is always a lie. You never tell a lie, no matter what the conditions. But Hillel was like, well, there may be some occurrences sometimes, right? Now, in this, usually the discussion is, well, when is it the right time to lie? And I go, I think that's the wrong question. I think the better question is really knowing why. Why to lie? If you're going to lie, because let's all be honest, we do this. We're actually really good at this in major or minor ways, right? But maybe asking why is the better question. Now, I know for some of you, this is moot. Like, you're sitting there right now, and you're what I'm going to call a Kantian deontologist, which is a fancy way of saying you like Immanuel Kant, and there are no relatives in morals. It's just always this way. You are Inspector Javert, all right, in Les Mis. At the end of the story, he can't let Jean Valjean go, even though he knows he's a good man. He kills himself so justice is served. Right? He's like, I can't give up this moral ambiguity. He just kills himself. Right? So for some of you, you're like, no, I don't play by that. It's always wrong in every circumstance. Great. I'm giving you permission right now to get on your phone, check your news. Now, under this point, you have a little bit of free time here and hope that your spouse doesn't ask you, what do you think about their clothing that they're wearing today? Because if you don't like it, you're going to have to break it to them, and it's going to be a rough ride home, all right? But for those of you who go, okay, let me explore the nuance of this a little bit. And by the way, I'm saying it's nuance, and I'm not trying to be overly zealous with this. I'm just trying to be a little bit more honest about a conundrum that all of us have wrestled with and argued with in a dorm at some point or whatever else, right? So when is it perhaps not right to lie? Or I'm going to say, actually, when is it not right to lie? First of all, it's not right to lie for convenience. Convenience, right? You get to the fair, you pull up to the window, you find out that 12-year-olds cost more than 11-year-olds. Your kid just turned 12. Johnny, you're 11 today. Like, that's convenience, right? That's convenience. You get pulled over. The officer's like, hey, do you know how fast you're speeding? I have no idea, officer. Yes, you do. As soon as you saw the light, you looked down. You know your speed. If you say you don't, you do, right? But it's a lie of convenience in that sense, right? That's the way it works. Also, not for a lie of advantage. A lie of advantage would be like, oh, my resume doesn't quite say what I wanted to say. I need to kind of puff it up a little bit here. I need to alter that I was fired from my last three jobs, so I was just I was traveling Europe for 18 months, right? Like whatever it was, right? That's a lie of advantage. It might be an exaggeration, or it actually might be a redaction. Sometimes it's very extravagant and big. Sometimes it's teeny tiny. Whatever it is, I mean, again, just take any political movement right now. Go, oh, that's what it's talking about there. All right, advantage. And you can't lie for agenda. Right, to get at somebody, to get you out of trouble, right? You did something dumb at work, and so you're trying to cover it up, you know, just whatever it is. Like, that's that idea. And all of those things really come down to, I am lying for my benefit. I would say any time where you're like, I'm lying for my benefit, either to get me out of something or get me into something, that's the dangerous territory, right? But there may be some space for something different. And in this, I'm just saying maybe, I'm not even saying all the time in every way, I'm just saying maybe, right? Maybe it's possible to have some lack of the truth for some higher virtues. I say higher virtues because I think that's what's happening even in 1 Samuel 16 when Samuel's like, what should I tell Saul if he asked me where I went? Because where I went was to anoint David as king. And God's like, well, then take a heifer and tell him you just went to go do a sacrifice. Right? Because he knows if Saul finds out, Saul will start killing everybody. So he says, just do it. So there was this higher value in play with some of that, right? Maybe that's it. Maybe in your own world, it's like you have a relative that's done something harmful, hurtful, illegal, and you're like, you know what? Let's not tell the kids about that. They don't need to know about that. Yeah, they're in prison right now. We don't have to give them the detail. Whatever the thing is, or maybe a time where you're like, it's just better to not, right? To maybe kind of cloak it in a different context. That might be a possibility. Another possibility is for some helpful, non-hurtful purposes. So this goes back to that debate between Hillel and Shammai. And the topic of their debate was a bride on her wedding day. That was the subject of the debate. And so they said, if the bride comes out and your neighbor says to you, is my daughter, the bride, so beautiful? Hillel says, she's gorgeous, even if she's not. And Shammai goes, no, she must know that she's ugly. And I'm like, no, she doesn't. And so there was this big debate between these two parties. Like, do you actually say something complimentary or do you not? And I was kind of reading on this a little bit more. And like a piece of advice was, like, if your spouse comes out and says, how do I look before you go to the party and it's not great? You go, you could probably do something different. Let me help you out, right? If it's at the party, they say, how do I look? You might want to take a different track. Because at that point, they're there. The time to fix it is gone. You just go, you look great, you know, and just roll. But that might be a possibility for that. And then certainly there is the possibility for humanitarian convictions, right? And these are the ones you hear all the time, like, was it moral or immoral to fabricate documents to get the Jews out of Nazi-occupied territories in World War II? See, it's interesting because Immanuel Kant would say, yes, that was wrong, 100%. You should have just turned over the Jews, right? Augustine would say, absolutely, it was wrong, 100%. You should have just turned over the Jews, right? Where again, like a Plato would say, no, it was more moral to fabricate that. It's like the Schindler's List thing. Was Schindler sinful or being godly for his actions? It's like that's the conundrum that's in there. And maybe for that would be there. Or helping the Underground Railroad, right? There was many Christian churches and Christian leaders who literally lied to officials to protect the Underground Railroad. Was that moral or immoral on their part? A more modern one is there are individuals and groups that go out and they pretend to be like either Johns or people looking to sexually exploit kids or people, and they pretend to be those perpetrators to catch the people actually engaged in sex trafficking. Is that a moral thing or an immoral thing to do? Right? And the list could go on and on and on, all the way down to something as simple as, I know of certain families where there's terminal cancer or illness in the family, and the person that is suffering will be feeling awful, but then they'll tell their family, no, I'm doing good today. I'm okay. Because they just don't want to burden the family. They're just trying to ease their suffering as they are suffering. I mean, all of that is in there. And so again, I don't want to come out of this, and I certainly don't want you to come out and say, our pastor said we can lie, man. Give that dude a high five. Like, that's not it. But I also wanted to give you enough respect to say this is a sticky thing, and I think most of the time lies are self-serving, lies are to get us out of trouble, lies are to get us ahead, and that's bad. But there may be some space where we have to at least wrestle with, is this the more loving and honoring thing is to deal with it? And I think that just takes wisdom. It takes wisdom. And that probably leads to our very last point, and that is regarding the skill of silence. Sometimes the best speaking is when we don't speak at all. Proverbs 17:28, even fools are thought wise when they keep silent. With their mouths shut, they seem intelligent. I'm like, man, Solomon be saucy right there, right? But it's so good. Like, sometimes it's just like, I don't need to say anything, because that's the wisest thing to do. Now, I know this is a lot and everything else, so if you want to fast track it, here's a simple little way to think about it, and it's literally the word think. Think. And I've used this before. When you're in any kind of conversation, whatever, just ask yourself the think concept here. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it helpful? Is it important? Is it necessary? And is it kind? Like, just that. Just think. Walk through, think, and then decide if you're going to say it. And again, this all takes wisdom, and this is what I love about Jesus. He kind of sends out his disciples in Matthew 10, and he's going to send them out to speak to friends, speak to foes, speak in climates that want to receive them, speak in climates that are going to condemn them. And he tells them in the midst of that, he goes, you need to be wise as serpents. Just be wise. And if you want to fast track a great quote on how to guarantee to be wise in all environments, Stephen Leverson said this: it is so simple to be wise. Just think of something stupid to say and say the opposite. Let's pray together. Jesus, I thank you so much for your grace. I thank you so much for this day. I thank you that we were fast tracking. We were trying to sip from a fire hose. But I pray that some little nuggets stuck for each of us in different ways that we know we want to work on and deal with. And we certainly want to honor you in all that we do. And so help us with our words. Help us to be healers, not herders. Help us to be wise and not foolish. Help us to be your hands and feet, right? Your co-workers, as we learned, in all that we do and say. And so, Jesus, we thank you and we love you in your good name. Amen. So the